I'm John Batchelor with my mate. See, I said that Australian fashion. My mate, Jeremy Zakas, and he's reporting on women's ashes. Ashes, I've learned from Jeremy, is the product of more than 150 years of rivalry between Mothership England and Australia. The first match was a grudge match, which England planned to overwhelm the Australians, who, after all, were not good enough to live in England. But, as fate would have it, Australia won. So what did the English do? They burned the sticks. That's why it's called ashes. Ever since then, the rivalry has been ferocious. You wait for it for the 18 months or 2 years in between. Except there's now women ashes. How's the match, the test going, Jeremy?
It's going fantastic for an Aussie. Not so fantastic if you're a Pom right now, because what's happened is the ashes, the women's ashes, just like the men's ashes, which will be played approximately a year from now, is run over five separate games all around Australia and is basically the best out of five games. And as we speak right now, the Australian side has won two games, the English side has won one game, and the Australian side right now is looking very, very strong. The women's team in Australia, I have to say, has always been very, very strong. They do very well at T20, the short form version of cricket. They also do very well at the five-day test. And it turns out, too, that when they're up against the Brits, they are very, very good. So right now, we're expecting on the round about the 28th of January, when we have this next game, we are hoping to see the women's side come out with full firing guns and probably win and completely shut down the Brits. But you know what? It's still over a week away, so there's still a lot of things that could happen in between, that the British could figure out a new strategy. The Australian women's team might lose some of their shine. But honestly, John, I think the way they're playing right now, we're expecting to have Australia win the women's ashes. So fingers crossed all around. I don't want to jinx it, but it's looking pretty good right now.
What is a Big Bash League? What happens?
The Big Bash League is a very quick form of cricket. It's basically played with 20 overs a side. So you get 20 overs, and an over being basically where a bowler bowls six balls to a batsman. They try and hit the ball six times, and then they swap ends on the pitch. So that's an over. So you get 20 of those per side to basically do your damage. And it's all contained within the space of a day. So there's a lot of time limits too. So for a Big Bash League, you're really only looking at a game that lasts 3.5 hours because it's made for television. So if a team tries to slow down, they actually get penalised, which means that for a team to really win, they have to get out there in the field. Their batters actually have to basically try and hit the ball over the fence each time and get six runs on every ball. And that is really the only way you call it a Big Bash League, which is where it gets its name from. Big Bash, basically bashing the ball over the fence because it's a very aggressive style of cricket. And it's one of the most popular styles of cricket now, John, because honestly, you can watch it in a single afternoon. You don't have to spend 4 or 5 days waiting for a winner. And it's just phenomenal cricket to watch. It is just really a hardcore type of cricket. And you have the young players too, which shows you some of the new and upcoming professionals that are going to be playing test cricket in the coming years. So it's just an all-round, really good form of cricket.
So the outfield is the same size as a regular test. The pitch is the same. There's no change. The platform is the same, and they play in the same stadiums. They just do it quickly in a day. 3 hours for a game? 2 hours?
They do. It's really around about three and a half hours. And I think because you have those time imperatives, it shows that cricket, even if you put all the other parameters exactly the same, such as the field size, the fielding, the rules are all exactly the same, except for the time rules where you do have a certain number of minutes between overs. Everything's the same. But if you put that little bit of pressure on and you have a team that's very young and very athletic, you can actually create a really, really interesting form of cricket, which is basically a form of cricket that's lightning quick. You can see the balls being hit a lot further than you would say during a test game, where players are a lot more conservative because they don't want to injure themselves on day one and not be able to play on day five. It's just completely the same except for the time limit, which is basically you'll get it done in about three and a half hours. And as I said, it is fantastic for television. It's fantastic if you run a busy life and you just want to go to the game and just watch one game over the course of an afternoon. So it's really made for the spectators.
They played one of the tests in Hobart. That's Tasmania, right?
Yes, that's right. That's right. Hobart is one of the stalwarts of the Australian cricket calendar. In fact, it has one of the best stadiums down there.
And it's a short flight, or did they take the boat over?
No, it's only, believe it or not, Hobart, despite looking on a map and seeing that it's actually part of the island of Tasmania and looks a long way away, Hobart is only a 1 hour flight from Melbourne. Or if you say coming from Queensland, which the most recent games were, it's only around about a 2.5, 3 hour flight. So it's very, very quick. And despite the distance it looks like on a map, it's actually very close to Australia, the mainland anyway.
And cricket is very big in Tasmania, and it's also very big in New Zealand. So everybody plays, everybody pays attention. And the women's
Yes.
success will be everybody celebrating the women's success or just Australia? I wonder how much nationalism goes into Ashes.
There is a lot of nationalism. And I think over the years, because the Women's League has actually grown phenomenally, especially here and in England, the Women's Ashes is on par with the men's Ashes in many ways. There's still the large spectator base at the stadium, so the stadiums are full. You'll still get 30,000 to sometimes 40,000 people turning out to watch them. It gets televised as well, so the Women's Ashes is actually well known in the media circles. The only difference is the sponsorship is still not quite up there with the men's. But honestly, John, the Women's Ashes has only been around a fraction of the time that the men's Ashes has been around. It's really only about 10 to 20 years where it's actually commercially taken off and been successful. So there's a lot of people watching this. And the women's teams, there are women's teams all around the world. So, like men's cricket, you have teams in Africa, you have teams in Europe, and you have teams basically through Asia. So there are equivalent teams all over the world to the women's teams that we have here and the one in England. So the Women's Ashes actually sets up the players that will go and play the tests over in, say, like India and Pakistan, where some of the major tests occur, just the same as the men. So it's pretty much exactly the same. And people watch the Women's Ashes to figure out how good the Australian and English sides are going to be. And typically, John, what we've often seen is the Australian and English sides are actually at the top in the Women's League. So this is just really a contest between giants in some ways.
We look forward to the victory of Australia when we report next week. We're going now to our momentary episode with Dallas, the 10-year-old Spoodle, Jeremy Spoodle, and his magpie family. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor with a tale that's fit for a children's book or maybe a full-length feature movie by Disney. Dallas is a friendly, very friendly, 10-year-old Spoodle, whom Jeremy adores, and Dallas is very polite and has a little kennel out back. Sometime in the spring of this year, a magpie family, which lives in the neighborhood, magpies are as smart as crows and don't quite have the rough guy reputation that crows do. But magpies are very territorial, very. Jeremy's taught me that in the springtime when magpies are breeding, you don't want to go near their nest because they will attack humans. They will attack cars. They will attack bicycle helmets. They will attack. Jeremy's been swooped last spring. However, breaking all expectation is a magpie family. And we've been watching this magpie family not only be cared for by Dallas, but to care for Dallas. So, Jeremy, The Adventures of Dallas and the Magpies, episode 12. What happened this week?
Well, John, this was really a sweet moment in many ways. It was one afternoon. It was around about Thursday. We'd just come home from work. Dallas had come inside and he was just laying down on the concrete floors, looking outside, watching the world go by as he often does. And then I noticed that the magpie family landed. He had Papa Magpie land and Mama Magpie. Then they've actually got two, we call them teenagers now. They're growing up. They're grey-looking magpies, but they're very young. And just their whole attitude is very much like the punk teenager you'd expect. So they're very bolshy out in the backyard. Anyway, they went into the backyard and were playing around as per normal. And then we watched Dallas. His little tail started wagging as it normally does. He clocked that they were there and he was just watching him quite happily. But then he sat up and I thought, oh, that's okay. He wants to go outside to go to the toilet. So I thought, off you go, Dallas. I opened the door to let him go outside and expected him to go around the corner, do his business, then come back in. But no. This time, what he actually did was he walked outside quite slowly, had his head sort of down in a very non-threatening way, just kind of watching. His tail was wagging as he did so. And he started moving over towards the way the magpies actually were. And I was like, this is interesting. I was wondering if he thought maybe they'd brought some food in or had dropped something off and he was just going to check it out. But no, he just sort of skulked over very slowly and very deliberately in their direction. And then he just planted himself pretty much at the end of the pavement, and watched them for a while. And the magpies, they didn't react. All they did was they turned their little heads, had a quick look at him, acknowledged he was there, and kept walking around. And I kept the door open for a bit because I thought this would only last a few seconds, maybe hit and he'd get sick of it and come in or chase them off, which sometimes he plays with them. But no, sure enough, he actually stayed out there for a good, I reckon, maybe 10, 15, 20 minutes while the magpies just wandered around him. He was just in the middle of it all. He had his head up. He was quite alert watching them. They could actually see that he was watching them too, which is very unusual because magpies, they can be quite skittish if they feel like they're being threatened. They actually look for the eyes in people and other animals to see where they're looking. And if you look at them directly, quite often they'll fly off. They were unperturbed by what Dallas was doing and just watching them. And Dallas, because he was so non-confrontational, was just laying down, his little tail would wag him once in a while. He just stayed out there with them. And the magpies just continued to walk around him, didn't bother him. He didn't bother them except just to share his space. And this, as I said, went on for about 15 minutes. And then by the end of it, the magpies had had their feed. They'd picked pretty much every bug out of the lawn, thank goodness, and kind of aerated our lawns and flew off. But then the funny thing was, there were a couple of crows off in the distance as well.
Ah,
And I could see them eyeing off.
yes.
They didn't come anywhere near us. And you could sort of see once the magpies were gone, and Dallas had kind of figured out there were crows and also some of the cockatoos as well, which are definitely not welcome, according to the magpies. He kind of sat up there and almost went into a protector state, I guess you could say. It was almost like he didn't want anything else in the backyard. And sure enough, he wandered around the backyard as if he owned it for the next maybe another 10 minutes while after the magpies had left. And then he came back in. But it was interesting. It was definitely a very cute interaction between Dallas and the magpies. And the fact that I think the crows and the cockatoos were just not allowed in the backyard either while he was there tells us something that Dallas and the magpies truly are a canine and I guess avian family through and through.
Jeremy, you grew up in the wilds in South Australia, Adelaide Hills. Have you ever heard a story like this?
Not quite as much. And I have to be honest too, where I grew up next to a national park, I had magpies pretty much my whole childhood growing up. We used to feed them ham and I used to hand feed them myself and would get generation after generation. So as one generation has new babies, the babies would come up to us, we'd feed them and they'd be quite happy. But we also had a Rhodesian Ridgeback too. And Ridgebacks are relatively big dogs. They're fairly calm and collective, but they never, our dog Ember, as she was called, never really got on the magpie's side. So whenever I was outside with the magpies, we always kept Ember inside just because she really didn't get along with them. The magpies were really skittish and didn't like her whatsoever. So I haven't actually seen it before. And this is the first time I've actually seen it. With Dallas so clearly that the magpies are interacting and very, very happy to. And I also see it a lot on the walk too with the magpies in the neighborhood. So maybe it's something that Dallas does that's a little bit more friendly towards magpies in particular, but it is very, very interesting. And I honestly had not seen it before until this.
Jeremy Zachas, he's in New South Wales where the weather is totally unpredictable. And maybe it's just weather, maybe it's climate. Can't tell. Here comes the fall, and we'll know better about the cycle of mice, snakes, dryness, and fires. We'll know better come the fall. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.